Ladies and gentlemen, may I have your attention, please? Those of you who are seated along the outside aisles, would you mind moving in just a bit? There are other people who will be coming in, and this will save you a new shoe polish job, perhaps. George Young and Father Duncan, you can take your stations at any time. Okay, Mr. Sutton.
Father Duncan and Mr. Young are on either side of the auditorium and will pass the microphone to any of you who wish to direct a question to the panel. I would ask that when you do have the microphone in hand, you direct your question to whichever member of the panel you'd like to have answer it. Please try to limit your question to one question at a time of 1 minute duration. We'll start, Father Duncan.
Mr. Grulio, I'd like to ask you if you have any thoughts about President Nixon's forthcoming trip to Moscow. What do you think he will discuss, and do you think this will have any future implications as far as the Russian-Chinese rift or are deciding to back to support either China or Russia?
My crystal ball is not as good as the crystal ball of this committee. I wish it were. Obviously, it will have great implications for the triangular relationship or four-sided relationship between Japan. But how it will go and where it will come out, opponents say it's not.
Were you all able to hear the answer? I would ask if you want to use the podium and the...
Unfortunately, I don't have as good a crystal ball as this committee has, and I wouldn't attempt to guess how that conference will go. Obviously, it will relate to the Chinese-Soviet-American relationship and maybe involve Japan also, for all we know, or Germany too. But what will come of it and what form it will take, I doubt Mr. Nixon himself knows, and maybe the Kremlin doesn't either. So... The only thing I can say is deponent saith not.
George?
Mr. Grulio, I'd like to ask you if you would comment on how you feel Sino-Soviet relations have influenced the war in Vietnam and how that war has influenced their relations and how you expect Soviet policy to play a role in the termination of that war.
That's a very difficult question and a very interesting one because there is still speculation about the relationship between Russia and China in the Korean War. A good many people in the West assume that China entered reluctantly in the Korean War and only when MacArthur came up to the Yalu that in the Vietnamese War, the Vietnamese have a long traditional hostility to the Chinese who were their imperial overlords for a long period, are very suspicious of them, and have come more and more to rely upon the support of the Soviet Union. You may note that in my remarks I dropped a little line about encirclement by Russia on the north and by Russian influence on the south, and that was what I meant. I think Russia at the moment is dominant in support of the Vietnamese. But if you think that either China or Russia can control the North Vietnamese regime, I would say you're probably mistaken. I think it's very much a situation like Tito or like Mao in the 1949 period, where they are their own masters accept support from everyone that has an interest in supporting them, and are going to go their own way in the long run.
Mr. Grulio, I wonder if you'd comment about the sense of betrayal that the intellectuals in the Soviet Union seem to feel as the U.S. tries to reach rapprochement with China, particularly since both of our nations, Soviet Union for the most part, and the U.S., are consider themselves Western, perhaps. Well, sort of.
This runs very deep. There have even been Americans who've speculated on, let's call it race feeling or nationalist feeling between China and the Soviet Union, and it takes some very strong forms. I meant to quote a brief passage from a poem by Andrei Voznesensky, who was probably the greatest Russian poet living, a protege of Pasternak's, which has gone all over that country, which I heard him deliver in 1968 in New York. He wrote it in 67. It was published in the Soviet Union. And it was called The Hound of the Epoch. And he said, "Hound of the Epoch, I sent Kuchum Khan in the air. I sent Genghis Hogism." And he was so obviously speaking about Mao and Mao's China. And ended up with the image of Russia protecting the West from the Mongols, the invaders, the barbarians, pleading with Suzdal Mother of God icon, this in a communist magazine, "O Suzdal Mother of God icon, we pray to thee, always Russia the savior at her blood's expense." And this was written with China so obviously in mind that no Russian could mistake it. This deep feeling that Russia had protected the West at the cost of its own blood time and again against the barbarian invader, even the Western barbarian invader, and had been beaten and beaten and beaten for it, and then now she turned around and found her own ex-ally confronting her, and she would save the West again at the expense of her blood. This was the tenor of the whole poem, and this feeling runs very deep among the Russians. Now, it has its counterpart in China. Russia was the country that protected her from the Anglo-French squadron and took the Amur. The Russian ambassador at the time of the looting, sacking of the Summer Palace during the suppression of the Taiping Rebellion, when the Anglo-French forces came in and destroyed the most beautiful structure in all China and looted it of its treasures. The Russian ambassador learned as a member of the Council of the Cooperating Foreign Powers that the Anglo-French were going to stop at that point and withdraw their squadrons and troops. So he went to the Chinese Tsangliyaman, the so-called Foreign Office, and said, "If you will sign the treaty we're waiting for, giving us the Amur Valley, we will see to it that Peiping is saved from the foreign barbarians." And the Chinese agreed, signed the treaty, and learned later that it was simply a trick, that Russia was again being her China's friend and protector at China's expense. And this historically has left a deep rut in the Chinese mind. Russia says she's our friend. Russia is not to be trusted. This is the historical experience. Russia looks upon China and says, "We have befriended you, we have helped you, even in the present period, we have supported you against the Western imperialists, and what thanks do we get? We get warfare on our border and a challenge that splits our whole mutual communist and national liberation movement." So there is bitterness, deep bitterness, on both sides. That does not mean that expediency can't gloss it over if need be. Americans have suffered rather emotional states regarding other powers, including Russia, and managed to turn right around, as we are doing today on China. So it will depend entirely on the course of the politics.
Dr. Potter?
Professor Yu, you heard last night that Ambassador Yost expressed concern that it's probably too late for any sort of two-China policy. What would be your perception of the role that the nationalist government will now be able to play in world politics and in particular in the UN, if any?
Would you like to answer?
Use this? Sure can. Thank you. It saves me a few steps. My own observations about the future of Taiwan are, at least as I see it now, can be explained from the short range and the long range perspectives. First of all, in terms of your last point about the future of Taiwan in the UN, I would absolutely agree with Ambassador Yost that there is no possibility of Taiwan being admitted to the UN, if for no other reason than, as you know, sir, that the UN membership first has to start at the Security Council. Given the fact that the PRC occupies the permanent seat and enjoys veto power, obviously it would veto. Of course, there is the additional point of view that the PRC sees Taiwan as an integral part of China, and therefore, how could it possibly approve of such? As to the other point, in terms of what is the future status of Taiwan going to be, I think if you all had a chance to read Dr. Kissinger's background briefing, and I think we can accept this, nothing is going to happen to Taiwan until after the elections, insofar as we are concerned. It's too delicate an issue, and I would certainly agree, but that's only a matter of 6 months, so if I were living in there in Taiwan, I would not be absolutely assured of my future. But that is neither here nor there, of course. But as for the future status, namely 5, 10, 15 years, there are two points of view. I think Ambassador Yost would say that given the seemingly present state of economic viability on Taiwan, it could survive for 10, 15 years. And perhaps he is absolutely correct, because he did point out, at least to me later on, of the cheap labor market there, which I don't dispute. But as I was to counter to him, my argument was that economics aside, that is not really the point. The point is that as more and more nations recognize and interact with the PRC, they are going to be subject to the oppressions that we are being subjected to by the PRC of withdrawing gradually, if not abruptly, any form of intercourse with the PRC, namely the pressure on those that remain tied to the Taiwan regime, who want or who might want to engage in economic or other forms of intercourse with the PRC, are going to have to surrender whatever forms of intercourse they have with Taiwan. The pressure is going to be very, very great. Now, let's just take one example. In terms of the economic problems, Taiwan's economic relations with Japan is as extensive as Japan's economic relationship with us, if not more so. Namely, more than one-third of Taiwan's economic interaction is with Japan. Now, Japan, as you know, is beginning to shift. It feels certainly the economic and other forms of necessity to shift, though this will not come immediately, but it is going to come very soon. So I would say, from my point of view, while I don't foresee any overt military invasion, I think this is completely out of the question by the PRC in terms of its attempt to liberate, quote-unquote, Taiwan, I do foresee considerable pressures, economic and otherwise, put on those nations that continue to remain tied to the Republic of China.
On this side?
Yes. I wonder if both Mr. Shankar and Professor Yu would comment on China's role in the Bangladesh crisis, and especially on the view that nations of the third world have of China's role in that crisis.
Mr. Shankar?
As regards China's role in the Bangladesh crisis, we have to go back to the period when the crisis developed. As you know, first there were elections ordered by the military dictator, President Yahya Khan. In those elections, the party, Awami League, which was mainly based on, at that time, East Pakistan, secured 167 out of 169 seats in East Pakistan, and thereby had a majority in the whole of Pakistan, because the total number of seats in Pakistan Assembly that was to be was 320. Out of them, about 15 were to be nominated, and naturally, the Awami League would have the right to nominate 8 other members. So they would have a strength of 175 plus some supporters in West Pakistan. Then then Mr. Bhutto, the leader of the strongest party in West Pakistan, said that if the assembly convenes, he would boycott it, and he held out threat against West Pakistani politicians who would participate. The assembly was postponed, further negotiations followed, they failed, and the military crackdown followed. It began on 25th of March. From what we see, the Chinese could not have been entirely happy about the situation where a government which they befriended and continue to befriend and which they supported and continue to support had to resort to massive military operations and was so unpopular that it had no popular base at all in East Pakistan, Bangladesh. After a few days, when the crisis developed, Premier Chuan Lai sent a letter of support to President Yahya Khan. That support did not extend to his internal policies. It was directed primarily against foreign countries, any threat coming from some other countries. Perhaps they had India in mind. The crisis continued, and according to the present Prime Minister of Bangladesh, Sheikh Mujibur Rahman, about 3 million people were killed. About 10 million refugees came to India, and about 20 to 30 million people were displaced inside Bangladesh itself. This led to growing friction, growing guerrilla activities inside Bangladesh, eventually leading to border clashes. And then on the 3rd of December, Pakistani air raids, declaration of war, and war between India and Pakistan. Now, during this period of crisis, when the issue was brought before the United Nations, China gave all-out support to Pakistan. They gave full support to Pakistan. And at that stage, while not attacking the leader of the Awami League, who is now Prime Minister and who was at that time held in prison in West Pakistan, they described the Awami League government and the Awami League leadership as a puppet, Manchukuo type of regime. That is, it did not enjoy popular support, it did not have a base in Bangladesh, and it was playing into the hands of foreign country. So at that stage, their support to Pakistan was all-out diplomatic support. As we all know, the war was over, and then Now Bangladesh has come into being. China has not yet recognized Bangladesh. China was the only country which withdrew their consular representative from Dhaka. About 45 countries have recognized Bangladesh. Those who had their consular representatives, they still retain there, including USA, whose consul general has been renamed as chief of the US mission. But I do not think that China has foreclosed all possibility of having normal relations with Bangladesh. It is possible that not in the immediate future, but after some time, China may extend diplomatic recognition. They would not be, it may not be in the first few months. They would have to, it may follow Pakistan's recognition of Bangladesh. But they have not closed all their options vis-a-vis Bangladesh.
Would either of you gentlemen look at it, would you, Professor Yu?
Well, this of course is extremely complex, a problem which obviously we don't have access to all the data here. But let me say 2 points in terms of, first of all, China's legal rationale for its support of the Pakistani way, or the way things that the Chinese at least have explained why it continued to support Pakistan and oppose Bangladesh. China argued on the basis of the principles of self-determination in the larger sense, namely that no other country has a right to interfere in the internal affairs of another state. And Chinese, the legal way in which China explained it was that this was an internal affair of the Pakistanis, and therefore no other country had a right to interfere in terms of what the Pakistanis were doing. And therefore the Chinese supported the Pakistani line. Now, but the other fact, of course, is that the Pakistanis have been China's primary, if not the only ally on the Indian subcontinent, vis-a-vis, for example, the Indians. And so we have to see from that. As to a point that we just mentioned, namely in terms of eventual Chinese recognition of Bangladesh and our the recognition, I certainly would concur with this. If for no other reason, and this is a very limited supporting data, if you had read carefully the Shanghai Joint Communique, whereas both sides called for the withdrawal of forces from Jammu and Kashmir, nothing was mentioned about the West Pakistan or the now Bangladesh land. So this obviously implies something. And to me, as the previous speaker just mentioned, I think this means maybe not immediate, but in the very near future, U.S. and Chinese recognition. Thank you.
this question is to anybody on the panel. Mr. Nixon said that his trip to China changed the world, and I think there is no doubt that it has. But in your opinion, is it for the better or is it for the worst, in the short run and in the long run? It seems that you know, the American people, at least the reporters on TV, thought that it was for the better. But it seems that the trip has brought about a lot of insecurity, especially in Southeast Asia. Would you like to comment on this, please?
Who'd like to handle that hot potato?
Well, I'll stop. I'll expose myself to the firing line here, and then we'll go down the line. well, I don't want to be too cynical about this, but when you say, was it for the better or worse, who? If you're talking about Nixon in November, well, you know, what's good for Nixon is good for the United States, as some people would say. So from that angle, I would dare say. But being less cynical, as one should, obviously, there is no denying that, as all would agree here, that this sense of non-intercourse, the sense of hostility, the sense of mutual suspicion between us and the Chinese had to come to an end. I mean, to repeat an old argument, the Chinese do consist of one-fourth, or is it one-fifth of mankind? They're expanding so fast one cannot keep track of things. And the Chinese historically, whether one wants to grab into the historical grab bag, have been the dominant power in Eastern Asia. Indeed, our whole policy of containment in Asia has been based upon the containment of the PRC. And given our change in policy, this would seem to be a natural outcome of it. So my conclusion would obviously be, in the cynical vein and in the non-cynical vein, this is a good move.
Anybody else willing?
Languages are fascinating, and the Russian fascinates me. It's a language that's very expressive of the country and its life. It contains words that don't exist in many other languages, such as roadlessness as a word. It also contains an idiom that was coined by famous Russian satirist Saltykov Shchedrin, who wrote a story about the Russian character, another Russian word, samodur, the self-willed fool, the bureaucrat who insists on the world should be the way he wants and not the way it is. And this man is told about the things that go on in America. People vote, all sorts of horrible things go on there. And he says, well, that's easy, close America. Because the Russian word for discover, you know, is to open. And so America had been opened by Columbus. He says, all right, close America. And this is now an idiom in the Russian language. Well, for 17 years, we closed Russia by denying her recognition. For 22 years, we closed China. It's time we opened up something, I think, our eyes. That's about what has happened.
On this, oh, excuse me, I'm sorry, Mr. Shanker. Go ahead. No, please go ahead.
Being accredited to the government of this country as a diplomat, I'm not at liberty to follow the good example of Professor Yu and Mr. Burloff to comment on some aspects of the President's remark. So far as it has led to normal relations between these two countries, it's a welcome development. But I would qualify with two other remarks. One is that the Shanghai communique and President's remark and the new world is only 4 days old. So it is too early for us to know whether it is a better world or not a better world. Secondly, it would be a welcome development, and it has been universally welcomed, if this reduction of tension, this opening, does not lead to an increase in tension between other powers and in other areas.
Mr. Shankar, China claims that unfair treaties forced upon them in the past centuries by the czars of Russia have created territorial disputes. Does that same sort of situation exist anywhere today between India and China that causes any territorial disputes?
Uh, I couldn't follow the question. Which particular treaty you mean?
Various of the various treaties which were forced upon China during the last...
Yes, no, but between India and China.
Are there any such similar treaties which were forced upon one country or the other in the past that have created any territorial disputes?
Yes. Well, I think you have the border question in mind, so I would take it that you refer to the treaty between the British government of India and the Tibet authorities and the Chinese central government, and covering what is known as the McMahon Line, which covers the border between Tibet and India in the northeast and part of the central sector. And the earlier treaty of 1842 between an Indian prince, Maharaja Gulab Singh, and the Tibetan authorities. Now, as you know, China's border, common border with India, is through Tibet. All the dealings, I suppose, Mr. Burlov and Professor, you would correct me if I'm wrong. Tibet came to China politically as part of the Mongol dowry, because Mongols conquered Tibet also. And after that, Tibet became part of China, part of the Chinese Empire. So all the dealings between Tibet and contiguous Indian territories were principally and in practice between the Tibetan authorities and the local then ruling Indian authorities. For example, when the Treaty of 1842 was signed by the Indian prince and the Tibetans after a war, then only the Tibetan troops were involved, so far as I remember. India herself was very weak, so there was no question of India in any way. It was dominated by a foreign power. So there was no question of India being able to impose an unequal treaty on China. As regards McMahon Line, this treaty was initialed in 1914 when Chinese central control over Tibet was extremely tenuous. Even during the best of times, the Dalai Lama, if my reading of history is correct, was very autonomous. But in 1914, the treaty was signed by three sides, initialed by three sides, the Tibetan representative, the British representative, and a representative of the Chinese central government. So as I see it, and I'm convinced about it, the treaty, these two agreements and treaties which are relevant to us, were not in the nature of unequal treaties. The only other agreement we signed with China was regarding Tibet. After India became independent and the People's Republic of China was established, the British used to have some small garrisons, a few hundred troops in 3-4 places in Tibet, some in Lhasa, some in Gyantse, Gartok, etc. Now, these small troops, these small numbers of troops, India withdrew as soon as we became independent. After some time, we gradually withdrew all of them. India and Tibet used to have border trade. So to regularize this situation, India signed an agreement with China regarding border trade, regarding establishment of Chinese consular authorities in India and Indian consular authorities in Tibet to help in the promotion of trade, and enunciated these, the five principles of peaceful coexistence for the first time. Those principles are now included in the Shanghai communique also. So this treaty, naturally, was not at all unequal. This was completely equal.
Thank you.
Mr. Yu, Mr. Nixon has expressed a desire to see the PRC and nationalist China negotiate in some way. This is an obvious impossibility while Chiang Kai-shek and Chairman Mao are still alive. But what will be the possibility of negotiation after these two gentlemen die?
Well, I think in a sense you have hit the question on the nail, so to speak, because one of the stumbling blocks certainly is the stubbornness of the respective individuals given the historical context of ever possibly entering into any sort of negotiation. If you know the historical context, which goes back to the 1920s, 30s, and 40s. So indeed, as I think most people would agree, that after at least President Chiang Kai-shek passes from the scene and a new generation of leaders on Taiwan emerge, as well as a comparable situation that happens on the mainland, then there indeed will be a possibility of negotiations, as the President Nixon and the Shanghai Joint Communique have implied. Namely, the problem has to, in the final analysis, be resolved by the parties themselves. And in my opinion, this is how it is going to be resolved. May I also take this opportunity to add a comment to what the Honorable Mr. Hanker just mentioned in terms of the question of the unequalness of the agreements between India and China. And I would mainly like to comment, sir, on one point, namely the Similac conference, or the conference that determined the Mac-Mahon line. I think, if I may differ slightly, my interpretation that it was an unequal treaty. Unequal in the sense, as it was just said earlier, that the conference was called by the UK because India then was still a colony of the UK. It was called by the UK and it was also attended by people, or rather the representative of Tibet, as well as the representative of the Republic of China in 1913-1914. Bearing in mind that China was going through a tremendous period of internal disunity, civil war, and so forth. Well, the result, as we heard, of the conference called by the UK was that you had the drawing of the Mac-Mahon line, which was primarily drawn by the representatives of the UK. In the end, the agreement that resulted from the Similac conference was not signed by the Chinese representative, but was only signed by the representative of Tibet and the UK. Now, India, correctly or incorrectly, assumed the obligation of this treaty, which was concluded by the UK.
What is the extent of friction that's likely to develop between the Chinese and the Japanese because of their competitive postures in economics?
Well, at least overtly, if you read Chinese statements, the Chinese perceive Japan as not only contemporarily a economic power, which could be said therefore to pose an economic the threat, but also on the basis of this economic power, Japan certainly has military potentials, if not actual capabilities. So the Chinese are concerned, or to put it in a different way, the Chinese obviously at this point perceive Japan as its major competitor in Asia. Now, my own feelings about this is that this is what is going to remain. Namely, they are going to be major competitors. And this is what the Chinese, obviously, are trying to prevent through all sorts of means, including the use of the Nixon visit. And my own feelings is that this is not going to succeed because Japan is too well established at this point. We are obviously not withstanding the Nixon shocks, are going to continue to be present in Asia and specifically continue our support of the Japanese. But the Japanese, having said what I said, are obviously very anxious about their future relations with the PRC. And if I'm not mistaken, if we can take at face value what the Prime Minister of Japan said several days ago, Japan, too, is going to pursue a similar changeabout as we have towards the PRC.
I'd like to add a comment about that Japanese.
I'd like to add a footnote to that, and that is this. 6 months ago, before the Nixon visit came about, I was consulting with some of the editors of the Boston Globe and discussing the Japanese situation, and called their attention to the fact that the Russians were already wooing the Japanese commercially and very vigorously, without much success, but very vigorously. They've had a good deal more success since the announcement that Nixon was going to China, and they may turn into a natural economic partner of Japan. I don't think you realize how perfectly complementary these two countries are in the Far East. Russia has exactly the natural resources that Japan needs, and Russia has a potential huge market for Japanese goods. There are now negotiations going on to create a port in the Far East, a completely new port where nothing existed before, Japan to provide all the sinews and equipment of this port, build the docks, not with Japanese labor, but with Japanese engineers, machinery, loan, and all the rest of it, to serve as a port outlet for trade with Japan, and also to pipe in gas from the huge Tyumen Arctic oil fields that Russia has opened up, and that are going to be very valuable to Japan as a resource if she wants to go on developing this relationship. So there is a great likelihood that economically you're going to see something of a close relationship between Japan and the Soviet Union versus a possible relationship between the United States and China. And out of this economic relationship may come political issues that will affect our future too.
Professor Yu, would you comment on the present presence of the People's Republic of China in Tanzania? What is their major economic help as well as their goal for their existence there?
Well, let's first say a brief word about Chinese developmental and military assistance to this East African nation. It's very extensive, as we know. It ranges from this 400 million Tanzania-Zambia railway, which according to people I have talked to, actually is going to cost twice the amount, to something like building the friendship textile mill in Dar es along, which turns out all sorts of fancy-looking material, to the training of the Tanzanian Police Academy, to applying MiG-17s, to applying Chinese medium-range the tanks, rather lightweight tanks, and all the other things, as well as agricultural aid, as well as building the radio and antenna stations and all this. But one has to understand Chinese aid to Tanzania within the Tanzanian East African environmental situational context. Namely, Tanzania is a country that is terribly independent. It feels threatened from Mozambique and the South African forces. Its aid from other sources have been repeatedly terminated unilaterally by the other forces, and it has felt that the Chinese have been one source that at least at this point they can rely upon. Therefore, the relationship at this point at least is very, very cooperative. Now, exactly what the Chinese presence means, and of course people have cited the fact there are something like 15,000 the Chinese in Tanzania who are primarily in the bush building the Tanzan the railway, so you don't see them too much walking down the streets of Dar es Salaam. And people therefore have asked, what is the real meaning of Chinese presence in Tanzania? Well, after having categorized the various types of Chinese projects and the presence of these vast numbers, I suppose the immediate response by most people is that obviously Chinese have imperial ambitions and the whatnot. Well, I suppose this is one interpretation. However, I don't see it that way, if we take the Chinese statements at face value, they don't see it that way either. Now, I am not saying that we should accept it, but I do think we should bear one thing in mind, that what the Chinese are doing is a drop in the bucket. It really accounts for a very small percentage of Tanzania's total security and military requisites, even though it looks very large. But even also is the Chinese perception of what they are doing. Namely, the Chinese, as we have already learned, are basically a poor country, have tremendous economic requisites of their own, and by extending aid to the Tanzanians, they obviously have something else in mind. And my own conclusions are these. Namely, Chinese aid, Chinese presence in Tanzania, while quite large and quite diversified, is really, in fact, a symbolic presence to show that the Chinese, for example, are a world power, first. Secondly, are concerned about development in the third the world. And finally, are anxious to show that its, quote-unquote, developmental model perhaps is relevant to the third world at large. So, in effect, for me at least, it's more symbolic than actual.
We have time for about two more questions. I believe there's a gentleman up here in the upper rows.
Mr. Grulio, in a way you just kind of answered my question before I had a chance to give it to you concerning Russian-Japanese relations and how they would develop. But I was wondering if you could comment on American response to a closing bond, so to speak, between the Soviet Union and Japan. And also, if you could comment on where Western Europe fits into the whole picture now.
Well, that's another big question. I don't think that Washington has worked out any clear-cut policy of response to the Soviet-Japanese rapprochement that seems to be in the making. I think we rather count on the Japanese treating it with great caution and reserve for some time, and we're not looking ahead yet to the possibility of what may be 3 or 4 years from now. As for Western Europe, this is an important factor, and it accounts in large measure for Russia's insistence upon a European security negotiations, a European peace détente, that it is pushing very, very hard and will probably succeed in getting within the next year or two some kind of détente in Europe, spurred by the relationship, the new relationship with the FRG, with West Germany. Russia, you see, has always, it's the double-headed eagle, the Byzantine eagle of the Romanovs, which looked east and west, and Russia has always suffered from the dilemma of divided pulls on her limited resources. So she has always wanted to have her rear protected in one side while she turns to the other. So it was true in the World War, it was true in the Civil War, it was true at every point in her history, that she has switched from one concern east or west to the other. And she is equally concerned now with settling affairs in Europe to such an extent that she need not be unduly concerned and can turn now to the Pacific as the next arena of future dispute. I think she is going to succeed in this, mostly because there are common interests involved. Western Europe as a whole wants to work with the Soviet Union economically and to a certain extent politically for its own détente. I think the United States has no real objections to such, even though we don't go along with it, we have no real objections, short of the danger that it may break up NATO, which of course is a long-range objective that is not likely to succeed quickly. I would like to add something to, in relation to this, that reflects on that earlier question about is it good, which the more I think about it is not such a bad question, and that earlier question about the Soviet intellectuals' attitude toward Maoism and toward present-day China. You know, the healthiest thing that happened to the internal life of the Soviet Union in recent years is Maoism. Because in the propaganda mounted against it, in internal Soviet propaganda, all the stress has been on those aspects of Maoism that raise echoes in the Soviet mind of Stalinism, and therefore have in effect been barriers, this propaganda against Maoism, barriers to a recrudescence of a modified neo-Stalinism at home, because you cannot attack those very aspects of dictatorship in China ascribing them to Mao, and those very dangers of imperialism, war, and whatever that you ascribe to him, without raising memories in Soviet minds of the Stalin era that all Russians would like to either forget or put behind them. And this is exactly what has happened. It's almost like a caricature of what the West says about Stalin when you read what the Pravda says about Mao. And in Chinese minds, you have a reverse of this hostility in terms of perceiving Russia as the revisionist right wing of the socialist movement, of Stalin's heirs as having abandoned the lofty goals of the revolution while China carries on the red flag and so on and so forth. The crucial point, I come back to this, the crucial point will be when, as after Stalin's death, the words panic and disorder will have to be mentioned in Zhenminjibao in application to the Chinese public, when divisions may arise among Mao's heirs. And if that happens, and the Soviet Union, by indirect pressures or even by physical force in any chaos that may arise, should step in, there is the danger point. And this is the one thing that all our concern about the Nixon visit has overlooked. If it should happen that in that struggle over the succession, if there is one in China, we have not demoralization afterward, but Sovietization, then I think the answer to that question of is it good, while we may have to say it was inevitable, it was necessary, The answer to that question is a good, maybe a doubtful one. We may say maybe it wasn't. Maybe it's wrong. I don't think it will happen because Mao is not truly, in Chinese eyes, Stalin, and I do not think you will have a de-Maoization and a pro-Sovietization, partly because of national interests, and partly because, in Chinese eyes, Mao is not Stalin. Mao is Lenin. Mao is God. Or Mao is the great leader, the founder. And so I do not look to that. But it is always there at the back of my mind as a possibility, and that will be the crucial point in the next turn in our international relations.
One last quickie.
This is to Mr. Grulio. What is your opinion on the different ways of dealing with the peasantry and modernization between Stalin's Russia and Mao's China? And I'm especially interested in China's emphasis on education.
The difference is black and white. Russia treated the peasant as the enemy, the man who stood in the way of changing the country and remaking the whole society, and put millions of peasants in the camps for resisting collectivization. I don't know if you're aware of it, but Russia lost more cattle and more horses, more livestock from the peasants' slaughter of them rather than surrendering them to the collectives than she did from the whole of the Second World War, and I can assure you that having traveled up and down that country at the end of that war, the sight of a live animal was rare. Collectivization was worse, and it was a forcible collectivization, and the peasant was made to pay for industrialization and then made to become the worker into the bargain. China has based her whole present stage of the revolution on the peasantry. It was peasant support that brought the Maoists to power. It was peasant support that sustained them all through the years. And it is peasant support, essentially, upon which the regime now relies. The improvements in the village thus far have been quite striking, and I am waiting for more reporting by outsiders of the situation in the countryside. From all appearances, the peasant at the moment is the backbone of the regime. Now, it can be that if China takes the path of industrializing, she will have to do exactly what Russia did to the peasants, especially since the peasant economy is not a rational economy in Chinese conditions with the floods and the lack of arable land and all the rest, the lack of equipment and all the rest of it. So that dilemma lies ahead about Russia, what China will do to the peasant in the coming generation. And there it will depend entirely on what policy she adopts in terms of modernization. My guess is that with this strong reliance, almost necessity of relying on the peasants in a peasant country, that the regime will go slow and will not try the drastic, forcible conversion of the peasant that the Russians did. As for literacy, I think this is one of the great achievements of both these regimes. But the Chinese achievement is only beginning. Russia has reached the point where she has a nationwide press, a press that is beginning to rival ours in circulation per capita. It's still like 13th place compared to 7th in the world per capita readership, which is a level of literacy. China is only beginning this step, and China has a very difficult problem of the complexity of the alphabet, as you know, or rather the glyphs. But it is a tremendous achievement, and I think if for nothing else, what this regime has done in cleaning up the countryside and in teaching the people the elements of literacy and what Russians and Chinese call culture deserves the utmost respect.
Thank you once again, gentlemen. We'll break now for lunch. Those of you who have luncheon reservations here, the dining room will be open at 11:50, and we will reconvene for the afternoon session at 1:15. Thank you.
People are making their way to our seats. my privilege to welcome you once again to the 4th Annual Quad Cities World Affairs Conference. And without further delay, I would like to introduce once again the President of the Quad Cities World Affairs Council, Professor Harold Bell of Augustana College. Professor Bell.
Distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, let me welcome you, those who are new to this third session, and welcome those who are returning to this final session. We're glad to have you. We're delighted with the turnout, and the program to this point, I feel, and I think most of my colleagues on the council feel, has been an outstanding success. And when we decided upon this program last July, I don't think we knew then what a spot we'd be putting Mr. Esten and Ambassador Yost and trying to Mr. Grulio and Mr. Dr. Yu and Mr. Sankar and trying to interpret for us such a dynamic and changing situation. At that point, we had no idea that Mr. Nixon would be going to Peking. And I'm sure that this will, today's keynote will put the icing on the cake for us. And without, since we are pressed for time, I'd like to introduce the gentleman who will introduce our keynoter for today. It's my pleasure to introduce the Vice President of Deere & Company, Mr. Walter W. Straley.
Thank you, Professor Bell. I know there are a number of my colleagues of Deere & Company here, and I'm sure that they join me in welcoming you to this your conference to this building. I hope you're as pleased with this facility as we are proud of it. James Barrett Reston naturally attracted the nickname of Scotty, having been born in Clydebank, Scotland, and receiving his elementary education there. His formal schooling continued in the public schools of Dayton, Ohio, and at the University of Illinois, where he graduated in 1932. Sports publicity for Ohio State University, a traveling secretary for the Cincinnati Reds, preceded a job in New York as a sports writer for the Associated Press in 1934. He married Sarah Jane Fulton of Sycamore, Illinois, in 1935, and the Restons headquartered in London for most of the time from 1937 until the end of World War II. During this period, he was with the Associated Press, the London Bureau of the New York Times, and was head of the Information Service of the American Embassy's Office of War Information Service. Returning from leave back to the New York Times, Mr. Reston became head of its Washington Bureau in 1953, has served as associate editor, executive editor of the Times, and I suppose a testimony to the confidence in which his colleagues at the Times hold him is that he became a vice president of the New York Times in 1968. At about the same time, he bought his own newspaper, the Vineyard Gazette, which in Martha's Vineyard must surely be conceived to be a competitor of the Times. Twice a Pulitzer Prize winner, Mr. Reston is a meticulous reporter, unappreciative of hyperbole. I hope he will allow my opinion that there are few Americans who serve so usefully in causing other Americans to examine their own cupboards of thought. As Reston said this morning, is a national introduction to conversations which somehow cause us to care a little more for our own opinions. While he is not a fancy man with the phrase, he is aware of the human need for spice. And I quote a concluding paragraph of his Washington column of February 25 as he was speculating about Mr. Kissinger's prospective tenure in the White House. Kissinger insisted when he came here that nobody could do his job for more than 2 years. But how do you keep them down on the Harvard yard after they've seen Peking? It's a pleasure to introduce James Rustin.
Professor Bell, Mr. Straley, I think I have to try to straighten out one or two factual points here. The Vineyard Gazette made much more last year on its invested capital than the New York Times. Indeed, it made $2,100.50. And considering what we invested, that was a pretty good return. I wish the Times were doing that well. I am not going to make a formal lecture to you as advertised, and I will try to explain why. I have been in the newspaper business for over 40 years. And for most of that time, I go to meetings like this. And some character you never heard of is introduced as being famous. And I'll tell you what we do in the press box while the introduction is going on. First of all, we run a pool on how long this fellow will go on. And second, when he gets out his manuscript, we speculate on who wrote it and whether he understands it. Therefore, I propose to stumble along here about China, and I do not certainly wish to deceive you. I am not a scholar of China. I have been there only 2 months in my life, one of which was accidental because I had an appendectomy and acupuncture while I was there. I do not know the language, and I'm sure that you all know the difficulty of understanding human contradictions, even when you can hear what people are saying. In China, of course, one always operates in a controlled situation. My wife and I were not modest in the requests we made to go places and see people. The Chinese are unfailingly courteous. They never say no, but they do not let you see what they do not want you to see. It simply doesn't happen. Therefore, you must realize that we were there for a short time. I will tell you briefly what we did so that you've got some notion of the limitations on our experience. We entered through Hong Kong to Canton for a day, visited in that area for 3 days, while, as we discovered later, they were getting rid of Dr. Kissinger in Peking without any reporters around to snoop on Dr. Kissinger. We went from Canton to Peking by train, a distance of 1,500 miles, thence into the northeast or Manchuria, again by train, another 1,500 miles, then back to Peking for acupuncture, and a five-hour conversation with Joe Enlai. after that, we came home. Now, the first question I have discovered since being home is that people want to know, how do you get into China? Well, in our case, I can explain to you, it was really quite simple. When the communists came to power in 1949, I sent a cable to Peking on behalf of my wife and myself, and 21 years later, it was answered in the affirmative. Now, I wouldn't have you think that we were totally idle in those 21 years. We raised three sons, and one of them has just got out of China himself. So there I have taken myself off the limb, and I will go on, if I may, to try to give you one blind man's guide of China and one's impression, or reporter's impression, of what he saw and heard. My first impression was that the Chinese are primarily interested in their domestic affairs. They talk a lot about all power coming out of the barrel of a gun. They have the illusion of all semi-religious revolutionaries, that the revolutionary system that worked for them is universal, and that if other people in underdeveloped countries can move from the rural areas, they can encircle the towns, and that they can achieve the revolution in the opposite way from the urban revolution of the Soviets. This propaganda to this effect goes on incessantly. Their propaganda by radio is more irritating, if it's at all possible, than our singing commercials in this country. But the overwhelming impression that we had was that they are so preoccupied with their own problems that questions of the struggle for power in the world, unless they deal directly with their own security, are secondary in their mind. First of all, they have no idea how many people they have. The guess is that it's 750 million people, give or take 100 million, but nobody really knows. In any event, it's almost a quarter of the human race, one human being out of every four alive being Chinese. And while we talk, particularly in this part of the country, about the days of and the psychology of American isolation, the Chinese have been isolated for centuries, long before we ever thought of the word. And isolation is the natural condition of their thought and lives. I was saying to Mr. Straley at lunch, for example, that in 2 months in China, nobody there asked us one single question about the United States of America. Their attitude was that we had come there to learn from the Middle Kingdom, from the center of the universe. It was not an arrogant attitude, though it's an arrogant thought, but they simply did not question anything that was going on in our part of the world. They have, I will come back to this point of the internal thing later, because I think it's the center of the whole thing. Let me just for the moment say one thing about it. And here I venture into opinion rather than being a reporter. We have had three wars in our country this century, since the Spanish-American War. The Great World War, four actually, the Great World War, the Second World War, Korea, and Vietnam. Those last three wars started in Asia. And what we have discovered, I think, in fighting those wars is that we knew very, very little about the psychology or history of Asia, which is one reason why I'm so happy that you here are trying to dig into the psychology of this new problem that we will have with China. But when they did talk to you in Peking or elsewhere, and you must remember that we had officials with us wherever we went, which meant that there was always an official of the Foreign Office who was probably a cop, very intelligent, very carefully trained, with us in these long train rides and long automobile rides all over the country. The conversation primarily in their mind is the unity of their country. And that is a long phrase for Taiwan. They said to us, if we heard it once, we must have heard it 100 times. How would you like if there had been a rebel government to your government in Washington, established in Hawaii, and there defying the central government in the District of Columbia? And China had sent to Hawaii in defense, in support of that rebel government, 7,000 or 8,000 Chinese soldiers. They even go so far as to take the island analogy to Long Island off Manhattan. To them, life is amputated without Taiwan. They are paranoid about it. As we've seen in the communique, this was the stumbling block to normalization of relations between Washington and Peking. They are, I think, convinced that perhaps we are not now determined to use Taiwan as a base of military operations against them. This, I think, the president has been able to do. But Taiwan, with a rebel government and American air power that can hit any city in China, is to them a symbol of the 19th century. The agony of their history has been that the Western powers felt that they had the authority to dismember their country and that they had to turn to the West to get rid of or to achieve their own sovereignty. They still feel that way about Taiwan, and no matter what conversation you start, the chances are that they will come back to that question of Taiwan. The second question that is on their mind is the security of their frontiers. Speaking to them about their relations with the Soviet Union is a very sensitive procedure. It is like talking to the true believers and the heretics of the church. They are more emotional, I think, about the Russians than they are about us. For example, in the conversation with Zhou Enlai, I discovered that all the conversations my wife and I had had with Mr. Chin, our interpreter, in the cars and elsewhere, that these conversations were all being reported back to him. And he knew that I had written a story about what I thought was the paradox of China, namely that it was a very old civilization which seemed in its modern generation to have the quality of youth. That is to say, of vigor and good health, cleanliness, and a sense of hope about the future, but that it was run by old men. And I was trying to think, since here was this old man sitting in front of me, how do I raise the question with him of age? When he relieved me of the embarrassment by saying, I read that you were concerned about the age of the chairman and myself. He said, you must understand the difference between your revolution and ours. Your revolution went on for only 2 or 3 years. Therefore, Mr. Jefferson and your earlier presidents were young men, whereas our revolution went on for a generation, and then it took another generation for us to establish that revolution, and we have not yet established it now. You may have noticed, he said, that there are great construction works going on in Peking. I said, I have. He said, we are building an underground city. The Soviets have 1 million men on the Sino-Soviet border in the north. We are not afraid of nuclear weapons, said he, in a nice, calm voice, and we are preparing to defend ourselves against any nuclear strike or any conventional airstrike here in Peking and in all the other great cities of China. Well, I must say that this seemed nonsense to me. I don't think I had heard anything quite so anachronistic as building shallow bunkers to defend urban areas against nuclear attack. But again, as on the unity of China, the defense of China, the fear that the Russians might make a preemptive strike against the one nuclear facility of China is very much on their mind. They come back to the Soviets all the time. They talk about them almost in theological terms. I must say it had crossed my mind a good deal of the time, or while we were there, that perhaps this was something that had to do primarily with the old personal struggles of Mao Zedong himself, rather than being a philosophy of the entire apparatus of the Communist Party in China. But that's a guess. I must say it seems quite odd to see Stalin among the saints with their great pictures up over the boulevards and in the great official halls of the government in Peking. But there it is. I would not myself, although this is a diversion, place quite as much confidence in the theory that the contest between the Soviet Union and China is irreconcilable as the government does in Washington. I can imagine the situation after the death of Mao Zedong, where new men and new theories will come to power, and the Soviet-Sino alliance could be put together again. Nevertheless, that is guessing about the future. We have, however, seen Lin Piao, who was not only chosen by Mao Zedong to be his successor, but had the Constitution of China changed to write him in by name as the successor to Mao Zedong. And yet within the period between Kissinger's first visit to Peking and the president's arrival there, Lin Piao disappeared from the scene. and we do not know now whether he is alive or dead. Therefore, I think we have to be very careful in trying to speculate about the future with China on the basis of the president's, I think, remarkably successful journey to Peking. But I think we have to keep in mind the volatility of the political system in China, and secondly, the enormous historical difficulty that the communists always have in passing power from one generation to another. We, in an election year with interminable primary elections starting on Tuesday, think that the agony of our system is almost unbearable because it goes on so long. But we do know how to pass power, and this is a very real question mark in China. Their third preoccupation is Japan. It's a very odd paradox. We lived in the Sin Chiao Hotel in Peking. It's an old-fashioned hotel, very comfortable, almost wholly occupied by Japanese. These are Japanese businessmen who are quietly doing business with the Chinese. And yet, it was almost impossible to have a conversation with Chinese officials without getting on to the subject of the threat of Japan. It is not surprising. The people who are in power now, when they were younger men, found themselves fighting against the occupation of Northeast China by the Japanese. They can tell you stories by the hour. Indeed, they will tell you stories by the hour, whether you like it or not, about the violence, the wickedness of the Japanese. And the farther north you go, the more stories you will hear and you will listen to. Now, it is not only that, but they can be quite logical about it. They say, here is this remarkable achievement. And they do say, the Japanese people are a great people. Look at what they have done since the defeat in the Pacific in 1945. They have been squeezed back into their central islands. They have taken control of their national lives. They now have more abortions per year than live births. And they have kept their population to 100 million. And they are now competing not with us, but with you within your own country and in the very center of your most advanced industrial areas of the United States, all of which obviously is true. They go on to say this country of Japan is now increasing its gross national product by between 10 and 14% per year. They are taking that money and they are investing it all around the periphery of China, and as their economy grows, their control over these other countries will grow with it. They believe that there is something in the Japanese character which will insist that military power defend their economic power and that militarism will be revived in Japan. They even showed us movies which have been produced in Japan over the last few years, which in the Chinese mind tend to show the revival of the militaristic spirit. I cannot tell you how tiresome they became with this argument. And I finally said to Zhou Enlai during this long conversation I had with him that nothing had surprised me so much as the virulence of the Chinese feeling against Japan. And I said to him that I thought one of the amiable qualities in the American people was that we had no memory, that we had been struck at Pearl Harbor, and yet there was no anti-Japanese feeling in the United States today, nor anti-German feeling either. A terrible mistake, he said. And then, quoting Santayana without giving him credit, he said to me, "Nations which will not learn from the past are fated to relive the past." And on he went with this feeling against the Japanese. Now, those are all political points of some interest. But I think to an American going to Japan, and particularly, I suppose I should say, to a Scotch Calvinist, the interesting thing about China was not Zhou Enlai or these political struggles, interesting as they are, but the effort of China to marry Confucianism and Communism. They are attempting nothing less than the moral reformation of a quarter of the human race. It is all pervasive in China. No matter where you go, the people are exhorted night and day to be cooperative, to be modest, to be faithful, to be cooperative, to be industrious, to avoid all licentiousness. It pervades the whole atmosphere of the country night and day. They therefore are going to force us, I think, to do very hard things with our minds, because these are two things in the American mind that we keep separate. We keep separate the idea, though we did not used to at the beginning of the Republic, the idea of religion, the religious, the moral basis, and the political system. And certainly we separate in our mind communism and morality. Indeed, since the Soviet Revolution, the one has been in the American mind equivalent to immorality. Now, along comes China, and China is experimenting with something quite different. Let me give you the hateful side of it, because there are two quite different sides of it. It is clearly an authoritarian state. It believes in what it calls democratic centralism, and perhaps the best way to illustrate democratic centralism is, if I may draw the analogy this far west, what Spiro Agnew would think about the right of dissent on the Vietnam War. That is to say, here is the central policy. And if the dissenter has a view which can perhaps improve that policy, then you are allowed democratic voice to express your way to improve it, but you cannot question it. That you cannot do. You cannot say, well, look, you told us in June that Nixon and all his running dogs were the enemies of China, and then you invite him here in July, and we don't understand. Well, that would not to be an amusing point in China. We went, for example, to Peking University and spent an entire day there, which was a very sad day, in my view. Peking University is a particular place, a special place in the history of the Chinese Revolution. It is, first of all, the place where many of the very best professors came after they had been in this country and learned the concepts of objective thought, brought back that theory of objective thought and applied it to the old Mandarin concept of government. And by opening, breaking this down and opening up the concept of objective thought, began the revolution. In Peking University, Mao Zedong in 1919 worked as an assistant to the librarian. And it was there that they began this process of revolution. Therefore, to go back there now and spend a day speaking to the faculty and to the young students, student leaders, is a startling experience, because there is a ritual wherever you go in China trying to learn about a place. You come into the place and they sit you down around a table. They give you cold towels, if it's summertime, as it was when we were there, and a glass of orange pop. And they say, this is what we do in this place. This is what the history of this place was. And then they divide the history of the place into pre-revolution and post-revolution. It is almost like B.C. and A.D. in their mind. Before the revolution, a catalog of horror stories about how dreadful life was. After the revolution, claims of progress, but always at the end, modest self-criticism that it isn't nearly good enough, that they are still an underdeveloped country, that they have not mastered the Industrial Revolution, let alone the Scientific Revolution, and that they must do much, much better. But when you ask them now, when it comes to the time when you can speak and you say, now I would like to understand who runs this place, you, the chairman of the Revolutionary Committee, does the Revolutionary Committee run Peking University? Yes. And you, what did you do? Well, I was an officer of artillery. And what is your educational background? Usually very modest. No attempt, as there would be in Russia, to deceive you about this. Because they say you should not be surprised. The purpose of this university is political. You must understand that about China. Its whole purpose is political. It is political in order to disseminate the thought of the central government. Indeed, they went so far as to say through the mouth of the head of the philosophy department that truth was Mao Zedong's thought. And I said, oh, come on, not truth, not all truth. Yes, truth. That is our truth. Now, this obviously is very hard for us to understand or to swallow. And yet I beseech you not to jump to conclusions about that and fail to look at the other side, which is exactly the opposite. That is to say, the moral revolution that is going on in China at the present time. Because they believe literally that there is a new China man. They are attempting something which is much more ambitious than the old days of the Reformation in Europe. They believe that they can teach cooperation, that they can inculcate in the young the concept of cooperation and modesty, and even until 25 chastity. They have, they claim that they have wiped out the drug trade. We saw absolutely no evidence of alcoholism. In spite of all those toasts, you saw Nixon drink. I never saw a man drink so many toasts out of a thimble in my life as he did in China. There's not the kind of drunkenness problem that the Russians have, which is a very serious problem. The little red book of Mao Zedong is McGuffey's reader. That's what it is. It's the old moral stuff, and no matter where you go, you see it in your hotel. If you look up the date on your calendar, there's a little saying for the day telling you to be nice to your wife or not to steal or to keep your room clean or something of that kind. And it's everywhere. It's on the buses. It's on the air. It's with you night and day. It's in the railroad trains. The books, the propaganda is all pervasive. Now, how does it affect family life here is what one wishes one could do really to find out. The lives of women obviously have been changed. Arranged marriages are as outdated now as foot binding. It's not true in Japan, but it is true in China. As a calculated policy of birth control, it is very difficult to marry before 25 if you are a woman, and 26 or 27 if you are a man. We had the impression that through their policy of directed labor, that even so, husbands and wives were very often living apart. She doing her job in one city, particularly if she is a trained and educated young woman, and he doing his job in another city. And very often the old granny taking care of the kids. They keep their own names. They are the most unsexual looking females in the world. I suppose they do know something about sex since they've produced more people than anybody else in the world, but you could never tell it walking down the street. They dress in blue pants, white waists buttoned to the throat, the body carefully bound in, no lipstick, no cosmetics of any kind, the most modest demeanor of any people that I have ever seen. They talk about birth control quite openly. The pill is available in all the clinics and all the communes and all the factories and all the apartment houses. Somebody in each of these places, section by section, keeps a record of what kind of birth control is being used by married families, though how they check up on that, I must say, puzzled me a little bit. They are giving their women, they say, equal pay for equal work. The observation that I had was that it was equal pay for unequal work, and that the women were doing most of the actual work in the fields. But it is true that in almost every commune or factory or school, there is a deputy chairman of the Revolutionary Committee who is usually a woman, very often a woman anyway, and there is absolutely no hesitation about speaking up. They do, very much unlike the Russians, always leave a period. At the end of your investigation into wherever you've gone, for your questions and criticism. They, again, unlike the Russians, admit mistakes. And when it comes to questions, the women, there's no kind of looking to the chairman to see whether it's all right to speak. These gals talk right up. And they talk very well. They stand up and shout. For example, in Peking University, when it came time for us to question and they asked us what we thought, I said, you know, we're trying to understand one another, and I have to be honest, this is not education in my view, this is propaganda. And then, of course, we were into it. And there were many sad, almost like Oxford group confessions by the old professors that they used to think objective thought was education, and they had since learned that it was merely propaganda for the bourgeois. And now they had learned another way. There had been no freedom for the bourgeois when the there was no freedom for the proletariat when Chiang Kai-shek and the bourgeois were in charge, and there would be no freedom for the bourgeois now, and they wanted us to understand that. But during this entire period, there was open, hard, sharp argument, and the women participated very actively. I think that about winds up what I wanted to say in my formal remarks. I'll just make one or two points at the end. Walter Badgett, over 100 years ago, when he was studying why some societies increased, progressed, and other societies declined, said that there were really two tests. The one was the right of discussion, and the other was the models placed before the people. If the models were good, then those good models would be emulated in the society, and if the models were bad, they would also be emulated. If there was discussion, then you could open up error. And if there was not discussion, you put a brake on the progress of the society. Well, I thought about that often in China, and I came away confused. Because while there is a great deal of discussion about what is the right and wrong thing to do, if there had not been, you could be sure that Richard Nixon would never have gone there. There obviously was one hell of a battle at the top of that government about whether he should be brought there or not. So there is dissent at the top, but not dissent of the kind that challenges the whole policy as we can now do with the Vietnam policy under our system. But in the field of models, I must say, the models are very good. They are almost saying, not in the old biblical sense, think on things true and things beautiful. Think on the noble things of life. But essentially, it comes down to that. Now, as you can see as I talk about this, I'm very impressed with this. I urge you not to be cynical about it. I think it is an enormous force in the world. I think it will be a force for good. I will be astonished if it did not touch something deep and Quaker in Richard Nixon. And I think in the contact with China, in the UN, where they will cause us all kinds of trouble, you may be sure, nevertheless, their entrance into the world will be good. A final thought about that, I found it extraordinarily paradoxical that to go there and see their revolution reminded me, in its models at least, of so many things which we celebrated at the beginning of our own revolution and are in the process of forgetting. The attitude of their people on the land is not very different from Willacather and the Nebraska Plains. It is hard work. It is dreadfully hard work. But the frontier spirit is there. And my guess, Mr. Chairman, is that it is a force in the world that we will have to reckon with, but not the kind of force. And this is the, I think, the great miscalculation of the past generation, not the kind of force which should make us worry lest they are going to go out plundering and expanding into the world, as we thought when we went to war in Korea and in Vietnam, because for the reason I gave at the very beginning, they are so preoccupied with themselves and their own human problems that I cannot see them, and I did not meet anyone who saw them there in the diplomatic corps who sees them as a great expansionist, belligerent force in the world. Thank you very much.
Okay. As Father Duncan and George Young are making their way to the microphones, I have been asked, Mr. Reston, on behalf of Dr. John Corbelly, Jr., the president of the University of Illinois, and Stanley Robinson, the dean of the Division of University Extension, that they send their personal regrets that they're unable to be here today.
Thank you, sir.
Unfortunately, they are tied down with budget matters, which I'm sure that you can understand. This is an especially critical period. All right, as we're getting the microphones, I will acknowledge questions from the floor. Right here, can you stand up, sir, and speak loudly? I'll repeat the question after you've asked.
You all hear the question? Well, a little while ago, some Chinese nationalist correspondents at the UN were kicked out after the Chinese communists came in, and the questioner wants to know what I thought about that action of denying press credentials and office space to those Chinese nationalist correspondents. Well, I thought it was a dirty trick. There is a bit of a problem in the sense that this was an official news service of the Chiang Kai-shek government. But even so, there are all kinds of correspondents at the UN who have credentials to report from UN headquarters, though their countries are not actually members of the United Nations. Therefore, as a general proposition, any
the denial of press credentials for anybody. I don't care who they are or where they are. I'm again.
Okay. Question here.
Yes, Mr. Reston, what do you feel was it that caused Nixon's visit to be the success it was? Was it Nixon's personal characteristics? Was it the timing that was right? What was it that made this a success?
Well, I think that I think there were a variety of things, and you have really to go back to the antecedents of the visit in order to understand the point. First of all, unlike a great many things, and as some of you may know, Mr. Nixon is not my favorite president. But this was a, I think, remarkable job of foresight on his part. He is, after all, a Californian. He probably thinks more about the Pacific than we do in our part of the country. He has a great ambition. His ambition is to preside over the 200th anniversary of the Declaration of Independence on the 4th of July, 1976. And believe me, I'm not kidding you. That is his ambition. And he has to figure out how to do that, because there is a small event that takes place between now and then. Now, he perceived this a long time ago, and when he saw de Gaulle in the late spring or early summer of 63, right after he came in, he told de Gaulle that one of the things he wished to do was to try to end the isolation of China. De Gaulle instructed the French ambassador in Peking, whose name is Manak, to tell this story to Zhou Enlai. Manak carried out his instructions, and this made quite an impression on Zhou Enlai. When the president then followed up with certain concessions on trade and so on, and finally raised the question specifically, after Mao Zedong had said to Edgar Snow, perhaps the president could at one day come there, they then began the process of sending Kissinger on that visit. So that's the first element in it, namely that this was a well-conceived and carefully planned diplomatic mission in which the president managed to establish his good faith that his policy had changed his attitude toward the communists. The second thing, which is probably more important, is that they both had something they wanted to get out of this. The Chinese are not terribly interested in style. And they didn't bring him there to give him a lecture on moral philosophy, you can be sure. They allowed him to come there with his television cameras and his satellites because they wanted it to be seen in Moscow and in Europe and elsewhere in the world that China had emerged from isolation. And for the reasons I gave you about their anxiety over the possibility of military action by the Soviet Union against them, for the men in the Kremlin to see the President of the United States landing in Air Force One and going around the Great Hall of the People clinking glasses, this is the sort of thing that Chinese, if they have a sense of humor, and I think they do, must have thought was very amusing. Meanwhile, Mr. Nixon had got a great deal out of it. He's been bloodied by the left on the ground that he was insensitive to the danger of China and through his Vietnam policy. And then suddenly he shows up in Peking. Well, you know, what can John Kenneth Galbraith say about that?
Okay, over on this side.
Yes, Mr. Reston, I spent a year, a little over a year in China back in 45 and 46, and I can recall at that time, in late 45, when we attempted to land at Wei Hai Wei, the communists had control. This is on the northern coast of the Shandong Peninsula, and we weren't allowed admittance at that time, so we had to go on around to Tsingtao. And what I wanted to ask you really was, in the North China area there, at that time, manufacturing for all practical purposes was non-existent. It existed strictly in small, little out-of-the-way places. And I was wondering, in this new revolution that they have over there, well, of course, you realize that the Russians come down into Manchuria and stripped everything out of, well, Mukden and all the other major cities. And I've wondered, have these people made any advancement at all in the manufacturing processes, say, of farm equipment, automotive tires?
Well, we went all through Mukden and were the first people to get as far as Dairan. They haven't let anybody into Dairan or Port Arthur from the west for 25 or 30 years. The steel mills in Mukden, or as Shenyang, as they now call it, are automated steel mills. I believe that most of that automatic equipment, moving that stuff around, the rails around and so on, was actually put in there by the Russians during the love affair before Khrushchev knocked it off. Everything using sophisticated modern computers or moving modern machinery by electricity was foreign. Tractors, yes, simple tractors, not to be compared with the ones in this building, of course, but simple, rough 14, 16 horsepower tractors, which they use on the roads to pull carts and put into the rice paddies to plow the fields. But primarily, it's a water buffalo society. And it's a mass society. I'm sure you heard Cronkite and the others tell about them putting a million people into the streets of Peking to brush the snow away. Well, that's what they do. That's what they mean by the mass politics, by doing things with the mass, because this is their great power. It's people power, and they move mountains with teaspoons. If you look at the land in the south and the rice areas, it's they don't till the land; they sculpture it. Sir? Is it bad? Well, it's hell on the feet and the back, I'll tell you that. Besides, you're not going to get me to argue against farm machinery in this one.
Mr. Reston, it has been suggested that in trying to establish perhaps friendlier relations with China, we have damaged our relations with Japan by riding roughshod over national interests. Would you care to comment on this?
Having said what I've said about how wise I think let me restate it. I think Nixon's opening to China and Willy Brandt's opening Ostpolitik to Russia are the two most important things that have happened in world politics in a long, long time. Now, that's the basis of it. Now, you can nibble around the edges of it, and you can argue with his tactics. And Nixon is paranoid about the press. It must have occurred to you. And the thought of the fun of suddenly surfacing Henry Kissinger in China and astonishing us was too much for him.